Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to What Clinicians Want to Know About the Management of Triple Negative Breast Cancer. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Kevin Kalinske from the Winship Cancer Institute of Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, and Dr. Heather MacArthur from the UT Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas, Texas. As always, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by us, just type them into the chat room and we'll talk about as many of these as we have time. As for all of our webinars, there's a 1 minute pre and post meeting survey in the chat room. If you take that, you'll get a lot more out of this experience. We know a lot of people end up listening to our webinars. If you're into podcasts, check out our Oncology Today podcast series, including a recent really interesting program on ovarian suppression in the management of breast cancer. We do webinars all the time. Next week, we'll be continuing our year in review series in gynecologic oncology. Really interested in what we're going to look into in terms of endometrial cancer, in terms of IOs. On the July 9th, we'll be talking about what's going on with multiple myeloma. I want to hear more about bispecifics. And I'm really looking forward to this July 17th program because I just worked with both of the faculty over the last couple of days to record their presentations. And it is really going to be a wild and very interesting program on antibody-drug conjugates in breast cancer. Of course, antibody-drug conjugates all over oncology nowadays. On July 18th, we'll be doing a program on ALK-targeted therapy in non-small cell lung cancer. But today, we're here to talk about triple-negative breast cancer. And as we always do, we think a lot in our programs in general about the community-based general medical oncologist and the primary target of our work in general. And I'm going to get a little bit into what we're going to do to try to address those needs in a second. First is to remind you that we will be talking about the use of non-approved agents and regimens, so check out the package inserts for more information. So what we did to try to really get down to the understand exactly what we wanted the faculty to talk about is over the last couple of weeks, we did a survey of 50 community-based general medical oncologists. These docs are not just taking care of breast cancer. They take care of CLL, myeloma, AML, bladder cancer, everything. And there's so much going on in oncology. It's really a challenge to keep up to date. So every now and then, we just like to take a breath and let them present a bunch of cases and ask questions. And that's what we did. We asked 50 oncologists. Each one gave us five cases. We had hundreds of cases, a couple thousand questions. And we picked two of these physicians to sort of represent the group, Dr. Ranju Gupta, general oncologist at Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and Dr. K.S. Kumar from the Florida Cancer Specialist here in Florida where we're located. And, of course, we worked a lot with the Florida Cancer Specialist. Both of these docs have been, a lot of times they're in our chat room, so they're probably on there tonight for all I know. But you're going to see eight cases tonight if we can get through them. We're going to make rounds today. Kevin, when he came on today, said he saved one neuron after his day in clinic for this today. But, Kevin, I think it might take a couple neurons to get through this. We'll see whether we can pull it together here. So let's just jump right in and get into some cases. Starting out with, you know, a very common question and dilemma, the management of patients with localized triple-negative breast cancer, but those who are older, specifically octogenarians. Dr. Gupta had an 86-year-old woman. She started out on the KEYNOTE-522 regimen. After two cycles, she gave up. The patient had been hospitalized twice already, all kinds of complications, and now is presenting post-op. Here's Dr. Gupta.
So the first question that I had was, you know, she has 2.7 centimeter residual cancer. She got very little neoadjuvant treatment. Knowing that she's 86 years old, what adjuvant treatment would you recommend? She had autoimmune toxicity, so pembrolizumab was not high on my choice. I just kind of wanted to know, this is a question that comes in our tumor board almost every other tumor board, if not all the time. We have 80 plus year old women with triple negative breast cancer, T2, lymph node positive or negative, and we often have a debate, you know, many people would not want to treat them just because of their age, right? That how will they tolerate the adriamycin-based chemotherapy, the KEYNOTE-522. You know, we always struggle with what's the right way to treat them. So I would really like to see what the experts do in their practice.
So Heather, any thoughts about octogenarians and neoadjuvant therapy?
This is such a great question. And there are 80-year-olds who have a great health forecast, and there are 80-year-olds who are very fragile. So I think it depends on comorbid conditions in part. I do give some of my octogenarians the first half of the KEYNOTE-522 regimen, especially in this case, she had stage 2 disease. And so I probably err on the side of over-treatment. Again, you're trying to prevent that recurrence risk in 2 to 3 years. And for someone who has a life expectancy that affords a 2 to 3 year forecast, I think that's reasonable. So I often give them Taxol Carbo and Pembro, so the first half of the KEYNOTE-522 regimen. But in some more fragile octogenarians, I have been giving, and again, this is not on label, this has not been evaluated in clinical trials, but I have been giving the CMF regimen, CMF being equivalent to AC, so it's excellent chemotherapy. It's an older regimen, but I have been giving it together with pembrolizumab. It's extremely well tolerated. Patients don't lose their hair. Their energy is excellent. And so I feel like that sort of straddles the risk-benefit calculation in this population.
So, Kevin, when I hear the word or the phrase CMF, I actually had the opportunity to interview Dr. Gianni Bonadonna, who developed, I think that was the first adjuvant chemotherapy given, very well tolerated, pretty effective. We were chatting before this meeting, I never thought about using neoadjuvantly. How do you approach octogenarians, Kevin? And we want to add anything that Heather said.
Yeah, I also tend to utilize that first half of the KEYNOTE-522 regimen. I often will do Taxol, Carbo, Pembro, and then depending upon how patients are tolerating this, I may get rid of the Carbo, may need to dose modify. It really depends on what's going on with the patient. And as Dr. MacArthur had mentioned, you know, we really see not all 80-something-year-old patients are the same. And I also do give CMF. There are data in patients with triple-negative breast cancer. I often give it for my patients also. I know we're talking triple-negative disease, but my patients who have genomically high-risk hormone receptor-positive HER2-negative, where I don't want to give chemo, but I feel like I need to give chemo, I will often give those patients CMF.
And there's actually a data set from Canada demonstrating that CMF might be superior to an anthracycline-based regimen for high-risk older patients. So it's actually a data-driven approach. But the extension of adding immune therapy is a novelty, though.
So let's move on to another case here. And this is starting to remind me. This case kind of reminds me a lot of issues that come, believe it or not, that come up in prostate cancer with the PSMA scan. And we're now starting to find out people with metastatic disease, often oligometastatic disease, and you start to almost see almost a continuum between localized and metastatic disease in some cases, like this one, a patient of Dr. Kumar.
Is that anybody who can go to surgery without neoadjuvant therapy? Most of the time you use the number 2 centimeters or less. Are they strictly adhering to that? Because I have seen a patient going for a second opinion and I told her you could probably go for surgery. She was 1.2 centimeters, but the tertiary care centers recommend that she takes a neoadjuvant therapy. That's one question we have. Commonly comes up, who can go for surgery? Were they really recommending not neoadjuvant therapy? Number two, after neoadjuvant therapy, when there is a residual disease, what is minimally residual? Who should really get capecitabine after that? Is it 1 millimeter tumor, should they still get it? Or it has to be absolutely negative for not getting it? One of your programs, I heard Sarah Horowitz mentioned that the study that was done was even tiny amount of disease patients benefited from additional extended therapy with capecitabine. The metastatic setting question is, it's approved only for CPS score of 10. My question will be, when you approve it in adjuvant setting, irrespective of the CPS score, why wouldn't it work in metastatic setting? Why can't we give it in a metastatic setting?
So Heather, I'm sorry, because actually the case was the next case, but this was several questions that he had that I thought, again, we saw so many people asking the same exact questions that he just verbalized. So let's start out with the idea of who can go directly to surgery, Heather.
So typically, I have been encouraging my surgeons to refer all patients with triple negative disease to medical oncology up front to make decisions together, because one of the challenges is staging at diagnosis. No, not everyone is getting ultrasound of the axilla, and the Beth Mittendorf and the Dana-Farber group recently published the pre-neoadjuvant phase experience with upstaging of triple negative disease and the importance of adequately imaging the axilla. So I think we're underestimating staging up front. And then with stage 1B, stage T1B, T1C, and 0 patients, I still recommend preoperative therapy because it's equivalent when compared to adjuvant therapy, and we're often surprised by the surgical outcomes, even when adequate staging has occurred up front. So there's nothing worse than having a patient who goes for upfront surgery who has node-positive disease, and you've lost the opportunity to give immune therapy. And as one of the co-PIs for the IMPASSION 030 study, where we looked at adjuvant chemotherapy plus or minus immune therapy in the form of atezolizumab, there was no benefit with the addition of immune therapy in the adjuvant setting in that study that enrolled almost 2,200 patients. So I hate the idea of a lost opportunity to create that vaccine-like effect. So I'm more predisposed to treat in the neoadjuvant setting, even for lower disease.
And actually, in the chat room, we already have a case from Thoy. How do you approach a patient with a 1.2 centimeter tumor, clinically negative axilla, who went directly to surgery but had two positive nodes? And the same scenario we've just been talking about, which I know you all don't support the use of adjuvant IO. But what about this issue of residual disease, Kevin? And as he mentions, people who have, you know, very, very small amounts of residual disease, how do you approach that? And I'm just going to throw in another thing, which is, do you think that cell-free DNA is going to come in this scenario and maybe help guide adjuvant therapy?
Oh, how much time do we have? We're going to open up fantastic.
30 seconds, guy. You know, this is a rapid fire here. We're making rounds.
Yeah. Yeah, I also, any amount of residual disease, I think about giving capecitabine based upon the CREATEX study. Same for patients with HER2-positive breast cancer, where if there's a little bit of residual disease, they seem to benefit from giving T-DM1. And of course, we should be thinking about, in these patients, having germline testing also just to make sure that they're not eligible for a PARP inhibitor. The other thing that I will say in terms of ctDNA is this has been evaluated in studies. You know, Nick Turner had presented a study for patients where he was looking at adjuvant pembrolizumab in this setting. But unfortunately, you know, a number of the patients, by the time that the ctDNA was detected, they'd already had recurrent disease. And there was another PARP inhibitor study that had been designed that closed early due to issues with accrual. And so I think across subtypes, there is the potential for the utility of ctDNA, but, you know, what's really lacking across all subtypes is just, you know, we know that this is prognostically important, but we don't know the predictive utility, meaning if we were to change the therapy, do we ultimately change the outcome?
So what about the last point, you know, he brought up, Heather? You know, it's all well and good to say that's the way the trials were done and you have to follow the trials, but it is a little strange that we don't look at PD-1 levels in the neoadjuvant setting, we do in the metastatic setting. Any thoughts?
Well, the challenge with PD-L1 status, so he's exactly right in that the benefit in the preoperative or curative intent setting was agnostic of PD-L1 status, whereas the approval in the metastatic setting is dependent on PD-L1 positivity. PD-L1 expression, it's a dynamic marker. It's not like HER2 where it's present or not present. It is dynamic in response to various environmental pressures. So it's a difficult marker to evaluate. And there probably are some factors related to prior exposure to chemotherapeutics that influence PD-L1 status that might make it more relevant in the metastatic setting. And we've seen a very consistent observation in the recent ER positive experience in the KEYNOTE-756 study, which looked at neoadjuvant chemotherapy plus or minus pembrolizumab, which was also agnostic. So PD-L1 status seems to enrich for response, but even the PD-L1 positive in the curative intent setting seemed to derive benefit.
So back to you, Kevin, from the chat room. Quick question. First, I'm going to say there's a really great case in the chat room from Lisa, an 83-year-old who started out with 522. Looks like she had inflammatory recurrence, gotten sacituzumab, gotten carbo-pem, nab-paclitaxel, but I don't see TDXD. So Lisa, please tell us whether this patient's HER2-low or ultra-low or whatever. But meanwhile, we'll get to that later, but back to another question in the chat room, Kevin. Hassan wants to know about neoadjuvant use of PARP inhibitors, for example, in BRCA carriers. There was a pretty cool paper a couple years ago. I think it was at MD Anderson. It was I don't know if has there been more stuff done neoadjuvantly, Kevin?
Yeah, that is the study I think that drew the greatest amount of attention. Study from Jennifer Lind at MD Anderson that demonstrated giving a PARP inhibitor alone could demonstrate some responses. And so it's not something that we're clinically doing, also understanding that, you know, in the KEYNOTE-522 regimen, we're giving a platinum. But given, you know, there were some patients who seemed to respond. I think part of the issue is just, you know, fully predicting who's likely to achieve a PCR with single agent PARP inhibition.
But we saw an exploratory analysis from Olympia demonstrating that the earlier on that you apply PARP inhibitor therapy, the greater the benefit. So by extension, it makes sense that it's more likely to be beneficial in the curative intent setting.
Yeah.
In my mind.
So Lisa's case is, quote, HER2-0. We'll get back to that later when we talk about HER2-low and ultra-low, which we had a ton of questions about. But I mean, this is the case I was mentioning before, Heather. I want you to react to this. Again, it kind of reminds me of some of the cases we hear about in prostate where they have limited metastatic disease because it gets picked up early. Like, what do you do? And here's a pretty interesting triple negative case in that regard.
This 65-year-old lady who presented an 8.3 into 6.9 centimeter left mass, accelerated adenopathy 3 centimeters, and she had a left lower lobe nodule 1.5 centimeters. So it was infiltrating ductal carcinoma, triple negative, and she also had a biopsy proven metastatic disease to the lung. So we started on neoadjuvant therapy based on 522, carbotaxol, pembrolizumab, and doxorubicin, cyclophosphamide, and pembrolizumab. And she had an excellent response clinically, and she needed to go for surgery. The question was, small metastatic disease, should we treat aggressive local therapy or not? We have gone over this. Three different trials have come out, and it's a case-by-case basis discussion with the patient. She wanted her breast out, period. So we have to do surgery. And the question is, the lung lesion is gone. Do I treat her like an adjuvant patient? Just give her capecitabine and finish the year of pembrolizumab? Or should I keep giving the pembrolizumab? Because in the metastatic setting, most people have given for 2 years.
So Heather, first I want to just say, you know, we're so appreciative to these docs for presenting their cases. You know, they present tough cases where maybe, you know, we don't really know the answer, and to put it out there, like, you know, a case like this where, of course, he, you know, went a step maybe a little more aggressive than some people would, but we really appreciate the fact that they're willing to put that out there. Heather, any thoughts about this case?
Oh, 100%. These are the challenges that we all face every day, and I really appreciate Dr. Kumar and the others who have shared their stories with us. Typically, when there is a biopsy-proven diagnosis of metastatic disease, I don't typically treat with curative intent, as is described here, although in selected patients with oligometastatic disease, we make exceptions, I think, although the data for treatment of oligometastatic disease has been a challenge. So in this situation where the approach has been to treat with curative intent from the onset, I would continue that approach and probably ask my radiation oncology colleagues about the option of doing SBRT or local radiation therapy to that single lung focus, and I probably would continue the curative intent approach and treat with capecitabine.
Kevin, anything you want to add to that? And I'm sorry to bring it back up again, but what about cell-free DNA in a situation like this?
I mean, I think that, you know, right now I would say across the board in breast cancer, the utility of circulating tumor DNA for monitoring remains an open question. And I think that, you know, of course, we check it in the context of if we were looking for, you know, identification of a mutation and selection of therapy based upon that. But in this circumstance, it's not something that I commonly would necessarily utilize. And I agree with Dr. MacArthur's point of, I think this is a patient who had documented metastatic disease. And I even think that, you know, once you're past those 6 months of capecitabine that you would normally, you know, 6 to 8 cycles that you would give based upon the CREATEX study, this patient has metastatic disease, and I would at the very least continue the capecitabine.
So I'm just going to throw in something before we get to another case, because I mentioned this case that Lisa had, which from what I can see, she's had sacituzumab, she's had a taxane. She's kind of running out of options. Obviously, clinical trial would be a possibility, but I would imagine the TDXD would be something to think about. And she's HER2-0, Kevin. So is there a way, can you treat a HER2-0 patient? Can you get a HER2-low assay? Can you work with your local pathologist to say there's 10% HER2 cells that's sort of HER2? This lady, you know, has run out of options.
Yeah, I mean, I have been in this circumstance, and I have tried to get trastuzumab deruxtecan in this circumstance. I will say that subsequent to that experience, you know, there have been data out of, for instance, MGH, which demonstrated that the more biopsies you do, the more likely you are to identify, you know, a HER2 low tumor. Which I also asked the question: is it related to the assay, it's like how we're measuring HER2 as opposed to a change in the biology. But, you know, there were also data that the Farber as well as Duke presented at San Antonio last year that demonstrated that the most recent biopsy, whatever that HER2 status, was the one that seemed to show how patients actually respond, how they responded to trastuzumab deruxtecan. Also understanding that the DAISY study, that patients who had HER2-0 disease also had a response rate of about 30%. So long story short, for this particular patient, I would be inclined to maybe repeat that biopsy and see what the HER2 status is, hope that it is maybe HER2 low, and treat with that. And then also, as you mentioned, this is a kind of patient that if she's a good performance status, highly encourage a clinical trial.
And then we'll get more into HER2 low. We've got some cases there as well. But just another quick case to bring up a point I just wanted to ask you all about, which is, what kind of autoimmune issues do you see in the neoadjuvant setting? Here's Dr. Kumar.
She had a right breast mass 2.1 into 1.4 into 1.7. I talked to her about giving her the neoadjuvant therapy, but she tolerated it very, very poorly. She needed multiple admissions. She had immune colitis and then C. diff colitis. So she got only a partial treatment, and we had to stop her therapy. And then she had lumpectomy. She had a residual disease of 2 centimeters, negative sentinel node. She did not want capecitabine. So we are just watching her. At present, she is NED.
Any questions you'd like to see the faculty discuss about immune colitis?
Yeah, I'd like to know, how long are they giving a steroid? I have heard in the beginning when the immune colitis came out, you have to reduce the steroid very slowly over a period of 3 months. Have they changed that? Are they doing a little bit more rapid tapering of the steroid? What will be the ideal way to do steroid reduction in these patients?
And of course, Heather, this obviously applies also to metastatic disease. We could spend the whole hour talking about this topic. In our webinar on Tuesday, Matt Gubins had a paper looking at predictors of colitis, you know, toxicity, GI toxicity, using germline markers from, I guess, ulcerative colitis. Any comments about detecting and managing autoimmune problems, specifically colitis? Have you seen that in the neoadjuvant setting, Heather?
So fortunately, colitis is relatively uncommon, less than 2% with pembrolizumab in the settings that we're talking about. It was certainly a learning experience with ipilimumab, which is the first FDA-approved drug, which led to severe colitis and even perforated bowel before we knew how to treat it. But it's relatively uncommon with pembrolizumab, although it does occur. It's worth mentioning that there are breast cancer specific guidelines around immune related adverse event management generated by CITSI, the Society for Immune Therapy for Cancer. So those are very helpful because they go through each specific immune related adverse event and give very specific recommendations. But yes, a taper of steroids, as Dr. Kumar described, is what's typically recommended.
Wow. So speaking of autoimmune disease, Kevin Thoy in the chat room says she has a 51-year-old patient with a history of MS, not requiring treatment, but stage 2 triple negative breast cancer. She put her on Keynote 522 and she did well, but I don't know about MS and IOs in the neoadjuvant setting, Kevin. What do you think? Thank God she got through it and all, but that sounds pretty scary. What do you think?
These two cases are speaking to my heart because I actually have patients that fit both. They're very similar. The first patient, I actually, you know, Dr. MacArthur and I go way back. And so I had a patient who was a young patient who had a small T2 lesion, uncontrolled thyroid dysfunction, was requiring IV Synthroid. I tried her on Keynote 522. She was admitted with a volvulus. And at some point, I just stopped her IO, and like she just finished her last AC today. And I justified that because, you know, in the original I-SPY data with Pembro, patients just got Pembro along with the taxane portion and not with the AC. So I have been in that experience, and I agree with what Dr. MacArthur had mentioned in terms of a slow taper where we start at 1 mg/kg. And then I also had a patient who I saw today. This is why I have one neuron left today. It's a patient who has MS, but actually is requiring therapy for her MS. And it was a small 2-centimeter node negative tumor. She and I debated, well, what are we going to do? I did not give her IO. She actually flat out refused the IO, and she got ACT and she had a PCR. And so, there are still patients that can achieve a pathologic complete response. However, we know that this rate is higher with Pembro. And we also know that patients can live longer if they receive neoadjuvant Pembro. So right. I do think that it's case by case.
So my team's telling me we're falling behind. No, Heather actually wants to run over. So she's got two kids with strep throat. She doesn't want to go home today. But Heather, we're going to try to finish on time here. The only thing I want to say about 522 is we're waiting for the survival data. You know, we have this press release. We tried to get it out of Heather. I'm not sure whether she knows it will be results or not. But she's not talking, but we'll see. Well, no, maybe ESMO, maybe
coming.
San Antonio.
It's coming.
And, we should actually have a RTP pool to see what the hazard rate will be. Just a couple things from the survey we did of these 50 oncologists. You can check it out later. We're not going to spend a lot of time talking about it. This is our CME waterfall plot of what's the lower limit for these docs and whether it's 2 centimeters or less. You can see there's a little bit of variability there. We asked them, what do they do with patients with a past CR? Almost everybody's following the protocol of using treatment. Now let's get on to another case of a patient, a 69-year-old woman, who is HER2 low, but she also has an ERBB2 mutation. Anyhow, here's the case.
She started with capecitabine for 10 months, progression of disease. We had sacituzumab that was approved at that time, so I gave that to her. We got about 13 months with that. And then when we had the presentation for TXD in the HER2-low, she was my first patient. Right after the ASCO presentation and approval, I started her on TXD. So that was about June, July. And in October, I got her first PET scan, complete FDG response, complete.
Wow.
I could not believe it, Neil, when we saw that complete response. So we continued that. And then earlier in 2023, she developed grade 1 ILD from TXD. So I stopped it. Her ILD did not resolve in 4 weeks. So I had to wait about 6 or 7 weeks. We did serial scans. I gave her steroids, restarted the TXD. She did tolerate it fairly well, but then had progression of disease. Now she has extensive skin mets, you know, peritoneal mets, hydronephrosis from that, a pelvic mass. I just repeated the NGS recently. Again, the ERBB2 mutation is present. I'm very curious, based upon the ERBB2 mutation, it still looks like the best response I got was from TXD. Any role for neratinib? You know, sometimes I've heard Dr. Joyce Shaughnessy talk about neratinib and HER2 mutation. She still has excellent performance status. She has no symptoms. I mean, even though she has so much disease and she's really wanting to remain treatment focused.
So, you know, it's been very interesting moving out from breast cancer to the other modalities trying to deal with TDXD. Now you have it, obviously, with pan-tumor approval. Everybody needs to know about it. And, you know, one of the things that's so hard to communicate to the docs, you know, who haven't used the drug is cases like this. You know, like an oncologist in the community who've seen cases like this, that's why they're looking so hard in the biliary tract cancers and everything else to see if they can find it. And Kevin, the other issue, of course, that comes up with this case is really interesting. And a big issue in lung cancer is HER2 mutations. And I don't know if we have much data on that in breast cancer. Obviously, that in lung, it's approved for HER2 mutant. And now with the pan-tumor approval with IHC3+, any thoughts about this case? Would you try to go after the HER2 mutation, Kevin?
I may. You know, it's interesting that this patient had such a notable response to trastuzumab deruxtecan. Of course, there's HER2 low and, you know, presence of a mutation. Sounds like that patient might have had a mutation at that time. And so we've seen data, you know, Kamal Javeri has reported and published data from the SUMMIT trial. These patients with hormone receptor positive disease were, it was, you know, neratinib-based treatment along with fulvestrant. And, you know, for this patient who's hormone receptor negative, I think it's worth giving it a try. You know, the question is whether you would also add in trastuzumab, like whether that's really necessary. But yeah, I think that if one could get it covered, it's not an unreasonable thing to try. Most of the studies have been single arm studies, but it's a targetable mutation.
So, and another thing that's kind of challenging as we deal with other disciplines, Heather, is to kind of get across the way you all established the how to manage or detect ILD. Because they are not like quite tuned into the aggressiveness of the way you all, and we kind of like try to explain to them what they do. What about cases like this, Heather, where you have a great response, then you have grade one, do you rechallenge, and that whole scenario? We get a lot of questions about that, grade one ILD.
So we do have some data that, so grade one ILD, just to clarify, and it's not a class effect. It is very specific to some of these drugs, including trastuzumab deruxtecan, which we're describing right now. And on DB01, we saw some fatalities. And so on subsequent studies like DB04 and the DB06 study that was recently reported, scans were done every 6 weeks, which is more frequent than what we do in routine clinical practice. So just a nod to how frequently those imaging studies were done on clinical trials. And the reason why they were done that frequently is that if you identify grade one ILD, which is asymptomatic ILD, and you treat them, then you can successfully, and we know this from prior Destiny Breast studies, that you can successfully rechallenge those patients. But if they have grade two or higher ILD, which is symptomatic ILD, even mildly symptomatic, you have to discontinue the drug permanently. So it is a real challenge in the real world. Most of my patients won't go for scans every 6 weeks. I split the difference, my routine practice, which is every 12 weeks, and I, for patients on trastuzumab deruxtecan, scan them every 9 weeks, at least for the first year. And the incidence of the ILD was really most prominent on DESTINY-Breast01 in that first year. After that, new cases are much less common. So I'm very vigilant in that first year. But I inherited a patient from DESTINY-Breast01 from Shanu Modi at Memorial Sloan Kettering, who had been on the drug for 7 years. And we really struggled with how frequently, and was NED with CNS metastasis previously for 7 years. Wow. And we really struggled with how frequently we should scan her, not just to look for ILD, but to look for progression of disease. So there are some exceptional cases with all of these drugs that we're talking about today, where historically we've talked about life expectancy of 12 to 18 months, and now we're talking about years and years and years of life expectancy, which is really amazing.
So the chat room is bringing up Dato-DXd as well, and also plus IO as something maybe for the future. Speaking of Dr. Modi, Kevin, any thoughts about more data from the DESTINY-Breast04 study, but also this issue we saw a lot of at ASCO about the ultra low, and like, you know, how do we can you diagnose that? How do you diagnose that? Let's put it that way.
Right. So at ASCO, one, you know, the DESTINY-Breast04 data have been practice changing and continue to be so. And then we saw at ASCO DESTINY-Breast06, which was for patients with hormone receptor positive, HER2 low. And then there was a small cohort of about 150 patients in the ultra low population. So those are patients, and it was randomized to physician choice chemotherapy, which included capecitabine. And, you know, it was really for those patients when they're transitioning from endocrine therapy to chemotherapy or infusion based treatment. And we saw this improvement in progression free survival. OS data are immature, and about 20% of patients had crossed over to get trastuzumab deruxtecan because, of course, it's approved. And so, you know, I think that for patients with hormone receptor positive disease who are HER2 low, then, you know, it gives, especially those patients that we need to get a response, it gives us, you know, access, potential access to the drug a little bit sooner once they've progressed through endocrine-based treatment. The question about ultra low, you know, during that presentation, I was texting my pathologist because, you know, of course, we're 0, 1, 2, 3 or ish positive. And I was like, well, what are we going to do? He's like, I'm watching the data roll out.
Find me something. Right? Find me some HER2.
So find me some HER2. Exactly. And so, you know, now, like as a group, we are thinking about defining things of, you know, whether you see any sort of HER2. And we've talked about how we're going to report this out. But, you know, every institution has different path that's available. Some use a central path. I think it really remains an issue of how we're reporting HER2, because we don't now report HER2 ultra low. Also recognizing in that study, it was about 150 patients.
And HER2 testing by IHC, it wasn't designed to look for degrees of negativity. And that's why I think we're having such a struggle in that space.
Yes. I mean, so, it does ask the question in general, like, does it even matter? Like, should we just be using this agent?
Should everybody get the agent? Yes.
Correct. Yeah, it seems like we're moving in that direction. Here are a couple of things from the survey. They're ready for ultra low. You know, 2/3 of them ready to do it now. They also, maybe, you know, general oncologists are using in lung cancer HER2 mutations. So they understand that, and they're more than half of the group is ready to do that for breast cancer if they could. ILD or interstitial lung disease, what does it take to permanently discontinue therapy? This kind of concerns me a little bit that 30% of the audience says get grade 3. Sorry, not the right answer. It's grade 2. And that's another thing, too, that you see once you get outside of breast cancer, a lot of variability in how people deal with that. A million questions, obviously, just a couple, a lot on our HER2. Also, another thing that there were a lot of questions about, Heather's sequencing, and particularly sequencing of ADCs. Now you have Dato coming along, and there are a lot of questions that we got about, do you look, is it the payload you want to change, the antibody, the target? Where do you see that? I mean, again, that's a huge topic, but Heather, any thoughts about it?
Yeah, that's such a great question. And we've seen at the most recent San Antonio meeting and further updates at recent meetings, some retrospective multi-institution data looking at sequencing. And fundamentally, if you use your best agent up front, it's more likely to be effective. However, those who don't respond to the first ADC still derive benefit from the second ADC, even when they have the same payload. So it's not a payload-specific question. It's not a target-specific question. There are a lot of technical issues in terms of the linker that may make one strategy better than another for selected patients. So we really don't know. So these retrospective data sets are interesting, but they're not controlled. A lot of these patients got chemotherapy in between their ADCs, and whether that has an impact on effectiveness treatment is under discussion as well. So we just really don't know is the ultimate answer, but prospective studies looking at that exact question are underway.
So a few words about PARP inhibitions in triple negative breast cancer. Kevin, you know, I was just flashing when we went through the slides over this meeting. Every time we got to a case, Kevin would go, oh yeah, I saw a patient like that today. I saw a patient like that last week. So and you've seen every possible thing. So Kevin, imagine you're walking down the hall making rounds and then one of the fellows comes out and says, hey, I got a couple questions about PARP inhibitors. We don't have a patient right now. I got a couple questions. Here's Dr. Kumar.
In a patient who is BRCA positive, how are they approaching triple negative BRCA positive patients, residual disease? That's a major, major question. I have heard faculty speak before. Some would use all the three, some will not use all the three. So how do they decide? What's the consensus or what do they recommend? If it's residual disease BRCA positive, what should I do? What do I tell them regarding myelodysplasia risk, AML risk? Is the risk the same in ovarian cancer versus breast cancer? What is the difference in the risk between these two diseases? And is there a difference between different PARP inhibitors regarding this particular risk?
So, Kevin, of course, everybody wants to know, what do we do in the localized disease setting with these particularly BRCA patients? Can you give them both PARP and IO, and we actually asked in the survey that question. Any thoughts about that situation?
Yeah, in this sort of circumstance, I do utilize PARP and IO. I don't give CAPE in this sort of setting. I usually am doing PARP IO, and what I have commonly done is give a cycle of the PARP and then add back the IO just to make sure that it's, you know, being well tolerated. You know, when other studies like TROPION-Breast03 was designed, which is looking at residual disease of Dato-DXd with or without Durva in the control arm, you know, when that conversation had happened of, okay, like, you know, what's our standard of care? It was recognized that some people are doing sequential PARP then IO, or giving it concomitantly. And so we don't have a right or wrong answer, but I would say I tend to give them together. Also understanding that, you know, there's some data in the lab that there can be a synergistic effect. And that's how I use that rationale for that.
So Heather, here's a recent paper from the Olympia trial that you all ought to check out, providing more follow-up of those patients. Just kind of curious, any thoughts about PARP inhibitors, your experience with them, and also Dr. Kumar's question of AML and MDS. You know, general medical oncologists got into PARP inhibitors 5 years ago with ovarian cancer, and they saw the whole AML, MDS thing, you know, played out there, and then you all came along and prostate, et cetera. What do you say to your patients right now about that risk, Heather? And also, what mutations other than BRCA will get you use a PARP inhibitor?
Mm-hmm. So as a reminder, patients who are treated on the Olympia adjuvant study were very high-risk patients who received chemotherapy, and most of them received the triple-negative population ACT chemotherapy, and there's probably a higher risk of myelodysplastic events with the cyclophosphamide, for example, from the ACT chemotherapy than there is risk from the short exposure to a PARP inhibitor. So most of my secondary cancer conversation actually comes around the, or is centered around the chemotherapy exposure more than the PARP inhibitor exposure. And at the point where I'm talking to them about PARP inhibitors or revisiting PARP inhibitors, they've already sort of lived through that chemotherapy experience and accepted that risk. So the risk of myelodysplastic with PARP inhibitors like olaparib is less than 1-2%. From the existing data. And typically this is a high risk population where a third of them experience a recurrence within 2 to 3 years. And so given that risk benefit calculation, typically the benefit far outweighs the risk. I do the same thing that Kevin does. I think given the survival benefit that we've seen from the Olympia study that I favor, for my germline BRCA mutation, carriers, a PARP inhibitor over capecitabine, and I co-administer with, pembrolizumab. I don't typically consider it for other, gene mutation carriers I do in the metastatic setting, but not so much in the curative intent setting. I don't know, Kevin, if you do something different, but I'm pretty consistent with just the germline BRCA mutation carriers.
Yeah, I would say I would say for somatic BRCA, I do not. For germline PALB2, I maybe would. I will only say that my germline PALB2 mutants have all been small ER positive disease. I haven't faced that circumstance. But if I had a super high risk patient, I would see if I could get it approved.
Did you see that today, Kevin?
I did it, but I saw a patient with IOD today from her trastuzumab deruxtecan.
The prostate people call a PALB2 BRCA3, jokingly.
Yeah,
but
I can understand that. There's good not a bad thought. There's good data for talazoparib and other drugs in that space in the metastatic setting for sure.
All right, let's get on to another case. You know, there's so many things that go on in triple negative, particularly metastatic disease. Here's a 73-year-old patient of Dr. Gupta.
2020, she developed a biopsy-proven liver metastasis. Her S142 testing was positive, so we gave her, based upon the IMPASSION study in 2020, nab-paclitaxel and atezolizumab, which she got for 4 months, had progression of disease, and then I gave her sacituzumab. So we started the sacituzumab in August of 2020. I have had to dose reduce sacituzumab, but she went into complete remission from sacituzumab. We got 2 or 3 years out of that, and now she had a complete response to liver metastasis. So what is about her case that she responded so well? And I wanted to know if anybody does that 1 week on, 1 week off with the sacituzumab. That did make the treatment very tolerable. I have not had much problems with sacituzumab, to be very honest.
How did she do on the sacituzumab in terms of her counts?
Her counts were not a problem at all.
So, Kevin, I was telling Sarah Tulaney yesterday when we were recording her talk that we have this way of doing quick phase 2 trials. And I did this after sacituzumab had been out for about a year. And we were doing a live meeting. And we do polling, you know. And so we did our poll question. And we said, tell me about the last patient who gave sacituzumab to. Did the patient progress, respond, or, you know, stable disease? And like almost 2/3 of the patients responded. That was our immediate phase 2 trial. We knew the drug had a lot of activity. But can you talk a little bit about your experience with it, A, in terms of efficacy? You see a very good effect here. What's the spectrum? Do most patients benefit clinically? And also, how do you sequence the drug?
Right. So, I mean, this is an exceptional responder. In the original studies, we saw response rate of about 1/3, this duration of several years. You know, the question about, well, what's driving this and, you know, why are we seeing this for this patient? It's a very good question. I don't know that any of us know the answer to this. I think we're only beginning to understand the resistance mechanisms to these ADCs. And, you know, as Dr. MacArthur had mentioned, the first ADC that we give tends to have bigger bang for our buck than, you know, the second ADC, though not always the case. If I had a patient, like this patient who had hormone receptor negative HER2 low disease, I still would start with sacituzumab govitecan and then give trastuzumab deruxtecan subsequent to that, just given that the ASCEND trial was a larger study and in DESTINY-Breast04, that population of hormone receptor negative disease was a small group. And so, you know, also the question about dosing and whether we really need to do 2 weeks on, 1 week off is an excellent question. I know one that has been posed to the company. You know, with Dato-DXd, that drug is given once every 3 weeks. And I think that, you know, 2 weeks on, 1 week off by comparison can be prohibitive for patients. And so I do think it remains an outstanding question about alternative dosing with that drug.
And, you know, Heather, you know, there, ever since the HER2 low data came out, we've been, we actually did a meeting a couple hours after it was presented, and we're still seeing the same issue about sequencing in ER positive HER2 low and ER negative HER2 low. And a lot of people, as Kevin was just saying, with, you know, ER negative HER2 low, go with sacituzumab first. You see the ASCEND trial here. Here's the most recent paper with the final data for you to take a look through. But, you know, I see a lot of people sort of reflexly think about T-DXd before sacituzumab and ER-positive disease. But then I think about the patient who's, you know, doesn't have life-threatening disease and, you know, the risk of ILD. And would you rather try a drug that doesn't have, you know, that kind of risk? How do you sort of automatically think about T-DXd first and ER-positive or too low, Heather? Or do you more think about, you know, these other considerations?
I think exactly what you're describing, which is considering the clinical and patient characteristics. So I think these are becoming incredibly nuanced discussions with our patients. There is a misconception that ILD is a class effect with these drugs, and that is not true. There is no ILD with sacituzumab govitecan. There is with trastuzumab deruxtecan and Dato-DXd. So it really depends. If a patient has large burden of lung metastasis, for example, I might favor sacituzumab govitecan. If they've had an issue with neutropenia, which is what that case I think represented, where they're looking at alternative dosing typically in response to neutropenia, then I might favor the Q3 weekly trastuzumab deruxtecan. So I think these are becoming incredibly nuanced patient-specific conversations, and patients are weighing in as much as physicians are in these decisions.
Kevin?
Yeah, I was just going to add, you know, there have been real-world analyses that have looked at, one, the efficacy, and then also the tolerability of sacituzumab govitecan, and the utilization of growth factors is up to about 50%. And I feel like that is represented in my clinic. I feel like I've never used growth factors as much as I have since I've been utilizing sacituzumab govitecan.
I actually use them up front now. I request Neulasta with a pre-authorization request up front with cycle one, which I give on day eight with sacituzumab, because I've run into consistent issues with the neutropenia. So that's become my new standard of care, is to request growth support.
So Kevin, I was mentioning this program we have coming up with Sarah Tulaney and Peter Schmidt on ADCs in breast cancer. And, you know, again, I just recorded their presentation. IO and ADC is like all over the place. Of course, you know, in bladder cancer, IO and ADC is now first-line therapy, and fortumab, vedotin, and pembrolizumab, which, you know, beat the hell out of cisplatinum chemotherapy, first-line therapy. There are a ton of trials. For example, this one here. Any thoughts about this strategy of ADC and IO, Kevin, in general, or about with sacituzumab particularly?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of interest about combining ADCs with IO. You know, some of the interest about, for instance, Dato plus Durva comes from the Begonia study, which has been previously presented at ASCO, 2024. We saw data from the I-SPY study, which, you know, we saw when patients just got four cycles of Dato-DXd, the response rate was about like 30% or so, predicted PCR rate. But then with Dato plus Durva in the immune positive cohort, because they're able to do additional profiling based upon mammoprint, you know, that was an arm that graduated, right? So Dato plus Durva in the immune positive cohort. So I do think that this is an interesting strategy. There are larger randomized studies that are looking both in the neoadjuvant as well as that residual disease adjuvant setting. But at least we saw at ASCO some additional signal in a cohort of patients with the combo.
And again, we put in a bunch of those trials for you to check out when you have the chance. Again, here are some of the findings from the survey. Let me just also tell you, actually, I want to get to some of the questions that came up, Heather, just to throw them out to you. A dosing of sacituzumab in elderly, frail patients.
So I typically start with conventional dosing, again, with Neulasta support up front in that population, and then dose reduce as needed. But typically when I start out with the immune boosting medications, I don't typically require dose reductions. And there's a lot of data across not just sacituzumab, but other studies indicating that older populations derive the same benefit from chemotherapeutic strategies as younger populations. And so discontinuation is typically to be avoided.
So also a number of questions about GI effects, diarrhea, how often do you see grade 3, Kevin? Also fatigue. Seems like almost every agent we use causes fatigue, but what do you see with sacituzumab in terms of GI toxicity and diarrhea?
Yeah, I mean, we certainly can see GI tox. I would say the rate of grade 3 or higher is relatively low. And also speaking anecdotally, I've never needed to use things like atropine. I've been doing, Imodium and or Lamotil for the majority of my patients when it's presented itself. The fatigue, I do think, is a real binding with SASE, and the only way that I've been able to mitigate that side effect is with dose reduction. I have found for some patients that has been helpful. The other thing to keep in mind with SASE is that I see 100% of patients lose their hair.
And cold capping doesn't work.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Really?
Cold capping doesn't work, unfortunately. And just as a reminder, in the ASCENT trial, the rate of grade 3-4 diarrhea was only 10%. So it's not the most common side effect that we see with that medication. And the discontinuation rates from the ASCENT trial were less than 5%. So it is generally a very well-tolerated medication, and these side effects are very manageable typically.
So I'll just finish out with a couple of words about new options that hopefully will become available. And I'm still thinking about that patient of Lisa that we talked about earlier with the HER2-0, if that really is the way it plays out, and she's not going to be able to get TDXD. Kevin, if we had data available, would that be something to think about for her patient?
Right. So with this, Tropion, like pan tumor study, there were some patients, there was this cohort of patients who received Dato-DXd, and there were some patients who had received prior SASE who also had a response. Not everybody, but some. And I've asked the question of, are we able to identify in any sort of way who those patients are? We don't. In that particular setting, for a patient with triple negative breast cancer where you're really running out of options, I think it's a reasonable thing to try. But again, there's no guarantee that we would see a response.
And, Heather, one of the things is so hard to go from a paper trial report, looking at a waterfall plot, to actually seeing patients. Like I was mentioning, that case that was described, the patient who did so well on TDXD, there's something that goes beyond numbers here. This looks like a pretty impressive waterfall plot, but do you have any sense in general about the level of efficacy with Dato, say for a patient like the one we heard about before with a lot of disease? You see responses in that situation?
Yeah, I mean, you have here on your slide, the objective response rate is over 30% in a heavily pretreated population in patients who hadn't received a prior topoisomerase inhibitor. That response rate was even more impressive at more than 50%. It does seem from Begonia, where you combine those strategies earlier on, and again, this goes back to the same philosophy, which is put your best foot forward as early as possible, Begonia, Dato-DXd with durvalumab in the first line, response rate of 79%, which is really an unprecedented response rate in first-line metastatic triple-negative breast cancer. And we're excited about those strategies, and we've moved them into the curative intent setting as a result.
So one final question, a lot of questions about, of course, anytime you have a new drug, Kevin, toxicity. But the one thing that's kind of interesting about Dato, and again, I was talking to Sarah about this, is the mucositis. Like, the, you know, lung also had, at the same time, had a big presentation. And the lung people are, don't know what to do about the mucositis. And according to Sarah, you know, the usual, you know, steroid mouthwash works. Is that your experience? Have you used Dato?
Yes, that is my experience. I will say it's really important to utilize prophylactic steroid rinse. You know, when we see the rates of stomatitis across the various studies, not all countries have access to the oral steroid rinse. And we've seen experience where the rate of mucositis is less if you're utilizing it prophylactically. So if and when this drug gets approved, that's going to be very important for us to be stressing for our patients getting it.
And it's not like the everolimus kind of stomatitis where you treat it and it goes away. You have to continue to treat patients for as long as they're on these medications. It's a bit unique in that regard. And there are also unique ophthalmologic issues with Dato-DXd, for example.
Yeah, they were saying, oh, there's ophthalmology. We haven't seen that. And I'm like, we have seen that for sure. We did a whole CME program just on ophthalmologic issues in oncology. Okay. Yeah, an entire, there's some, you know, ADCs, you know, myeloma, they have this, like all over the central serous retinopathy with erdafitinib. I mean, there's a lot of eye things going on. Final thing, I don't know what we're going to call this, SASI TMT, I guess. It's sort of some variation of sacituzumab, but maybe with a slightly different tolerability. Kevin, what's your take about this? We saw these data at ASCO, the new SASI, I guess.
Yeah. Well, one, I just want to say I did not see any opto issues in clinic today. So that is one thing I did not say.
Oh, that's good. you will.
all right. But I will say, I mean, this seems to be an active drug. It has, to me, and I've not treated patients with this agent, just, you know, based upon the toxicity that were reported at San Antonio, it seems somewhere between SASI and Dato-XD. They do see some stomatitis with this agent, but this agent is moving forward in randomized trials and ongoing randomized studies and is moving up pretty quickly in development.
And patritumab is another interesting ADC. We got a lot of questions about measuring HER3, but I don't think you do measure it. You just give it. At least that's one of those drugs like, I guess, some of the TROP2 drugs that you just give it anyhow. And finally, and fortumab vedotin, I can't believe, has finally come to breast cancer. Maybe we'll circle back and you'll end up using EV Pembro like they're doing in bladder. It also has a lot of skin issues. It's not necessarily an easy drug to use. Any thoughts about this, Heather? And do you think that this may end up coming into breast cancer therapy? Not an easy drug.
No, I mean, the bladder plenary presentation was impressive. And I think Tom Powles was just recently, who presented, was just recently named in the Time 100 Healthcare Professionals list as a result. It's hard to understand how this will fit in because we have moved so expeditiously forward with ADCs. We had the first solid tumor ADC approval in the form of T-DM1, and it has just been explosive since then. So it's really hard to understand how this drug would fit into a very dynamic landscape at this point in time, for me.
So actually, we had Tom Powles on our webinar last night, and I was just trying to imagine he's with Peter Schmidt, the two of them together. Can you imagine?
Yes.
Can you imagine like when you make rounds with the two of them?
I know.
Anyhow, Heather and Kevin, thank you so much for working with us tonight. Audience, thank you for attending. It was kind of wild and woolly, but hopefully you got something out of it. Coming back next Tuesday, we'll see what Dr. Chase has to say about what's new in gynecologic oncology again, particularly IOs and endometrial cancer. Super fascinating. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Heather. Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you so
much. Have a good one.
You too.
Take care.